From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
So tired, tired of waiting, tired of waiting for you.
On today's Fresh Air, we continue our holiday week series of recent interviews with great songwriters and singers. First, we'll hear from Ray Davies, who co-founded the Kinks. This year, he released his first solo album of new original songs. Before he completed it, he was shot in the leg while chasing after the guy who stole his girlfriend's purse. We'll also hear from Tom Petty. It's been 30 years since he released his first album with the Heartbreakers. Since then, they've sold more than 50 million records. This year, Petty released a new album called Highway Companion. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
Do what you like, but please don't keep me waiting.
First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're presenting a holiday series featuring recent interviews with great songwriters and singers. In April, I spoke with Ray Davies, the co-founder of The Kinks. He released his first solo record of new original songs last spring. Before we hear about it, here's a Kinks hit from 1965 that you may be able to identify in two notes.
In the daytime.
That record, All Day and All of the Night, along with You Really Got Me, Tired of Waiting for You, A Well-Respected Man, Lola, Sunny Afternoon, and Waterloo Sunset, made the Kinks one of the great and enduring British bands that came out of the 60s. But they haven't made an album of new songs since 1993. My guest Ray Davies wrote and sang most of the Kinks songs. His brother Dave was featured on guitar. The solo album of new songs Ray Davies released this year, called Other People's Lives, was described in Rolling Stone as a masterpiece. Before completing the record, Davies was shot in New Orleans while chasing a guy who stole his girlfriend's purse. But we'll get to that story a little later. Here's the opening track of Other People's Lives. It's called Things Change.
Things are gonna change. This is a morning. When reality bites, the morality kicks in to those damaged limitations. This is the morning after all that went before, all of the sunlight laughter. Things are gonna change. This is the morning after.
That's Ray Davies from his new CD, Other People's Lives. Ray Davies, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Hi, how are you?
Why is this your first ever solo record? Why has it taken this long?
I think being in the Kinks for so long was just I didn't realize until I wasn't with the band how life-consuming it was, how much of my life was wrapped up in it. And me as a person, you know, you have to remember that I started this when I was just college, you know. I was barely formed as a human being and as a character. And I grew up in that band. And I had my life experience, in many respects, is limited to being in the band. So when I came to record this record, I had to find out who I was as an individual, because all the Kinks music was part, it was part of a machine, part of a, I know I wrote the songs, so I had an element of freedom, but everything had to be targeted. It was a Kinks, as you say, product.
Now, the way I've read it, it sounds like you came to the United States as part of that process of writing new songs. You wanted to get away from the environment that you'd written in all along. So.
Yeah.
Was that the reason for moving to the States for a while?
Well, Things Are Going to Change was written while I was still living in Surrey in England. It's a nice, very rural, there. And maybe I was saying to myself, things have got to change in my life. I've got to move on. You know, I don't know how a person can sit in one house all their lives and write lots of books, songs, and poetry. I needed to go on a journey. And that's what it felt like. It wasn't enough being not with the band. I needed to have an upheaval of some sort. You know, looking, it's easy to say it now, but I didn't know it then. So I came to America, 2001, toured here, just after 9/11, and I was writing songs and shooting my own video diary on the road.
So I know you spent a good deal of time in New Orleans. Did you move to New Orleans?
After the tour was over, I went back to New York, where I was based, and realized I needed to find, and this sounds very grand, but I wanted to find the source of the music that inspired me when I first started out. And the country that made me want to pick up the guitar was America. That, you know, it was American music. And all the people I was inspired by, from Hank Williams, country music, Big Bill Brunzi, who came from Chicago, but I think was actually born in Mississippi, all somehow had a connection with the South. And, you know, I liked Dixieland as a kid. You know, we had a lot of that music in the house. And I went to the Highgate Jazz Club where I grew up and saw Dixieland. So I wanted to go there and see it. And I went for some personal reasons. I went on a personal visit as well. But I grew attracted to the place.
Let's hear one of the songs that I think relates in some way to New Orleans. It's called The Getaway. And it starts with a line about, you know, lonesome train. And that's such an American blues kind of thing. Mm. I don't know. There's a lot of trains in England. I don't know that you'd associate them with, like, the lonesome train.
Absolutely. I'm very coy about using phrases and terms that have been used by other people. I love blues music, but I never attempt to be a blues man.
Mm.
And lonesome trains, yeah, the lonesome whistles and all that from the classic Hank Williams songs and the blues men, as you said. But I was there, and every morning I'd hear that train coming in, and it woke me every morning, and I loved hearing it. It was like a friend. And it reminded me of where I grew up in North London. I lived very close to a train track. And it was a comfort zone for me to be there. But then, you know, this element of change in my life I was going through with relationships and personal life. The line just came into my head, and I didn't feel ashamed or feel coy about using every time I hear that lonesome train roll down the track. My only concern, it was a lot for me to say in one breath. That's all that worried me. It's just because you're there. You see, I'm not writing blues music, I'm not writing jazz, I'm in New Orleans, but I'm seeing the world in a slightly different way. I'm not ashamed to say things like that. And that's good enough. And that's worth the journey.
Well, let's hear The Getaway. And this is from Ray Davies' new album, which is called Other People's Lives.
Every time I hear that lonesome train roll down the track, going away to unknown destination, just moving on, suddenly gone, and so unexpectedly. It might hit you on a sunny afternoon. Without a warning, there's a thought, it just comes over.
That's The Getaway from Ray Davies' new CD, which is called Other People's Lives, and it's his first solo CD. All of his other CDs have been as a member of the Kinks. I really like the song a lot, and to me it's a song about, you know, somebody who makes their getaway from a relationship or from a neighborhood or a home or maybe even from life itself. Mm. Somebody who's just, you know, made the final exit intentionally.
Yeah.
I don't know if you feel that way, but as a listener, it seems to me it's speaking on all those levels.
That's precisely the level I was, or the levels I was writing about. You know, the secret is, though, not to know it when you're writing it.
Uh-huh.
Just to feel and do all the analysis later on. I don't intellectualize what I write because I think my instinct is smarter than my actual being. And there's a long fade out in that song, and there's a reason for that. It goes on and on and on, And if you just think about it, it's like there's a punchline and a voice, a deep voice comes up at the end, it's like whispering in my ears, the singer's ear, saying, yeah, man, it's time to get out the door. It's time to make that move. You've been saying it all your life. Do it. You know, make the move or you're going to get the lonesome train. So the lonesome train is isolation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Was there something specific you were making your getaway from when you wrote that song?
I think there's an element of escape on the entire record. It's a theme that goes through it. Again, not knowing it. So I'm sitting down in my little studio in Surrey in England, 1998, thinking I have to get away from this mm-hmm. if I'm going to keep writing.
My guest is Ray Davies. He'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview I recorded in April with songwriter and singer Ray Davies, the co-founder of The Kinks. This year, he released his first solo album of new original songs. While he was finishing it, he was shot. This is a pretty horrible story. Some of our listeners, I'm sure, have already heard it. But while you were living in New Orleans...
Well, it was when I'd moved out to start... I came back to England at the end of 2003... to finish the recording. All the songs on this album were written prior to 2004 and recorded. And I went over to New Orleans. We were going to have a holiday there, New Year's, spend New Year's, and we had a good New Year's Eve there. And about the 4th of January 2004, I got attacked and shot, yeah. It's was quite harrowing.
Would you describe what happened?
Well, just walking around the street, walked around. I used to go jogging a lot at night, on my bicycle. I love cycling in New Orleans. And this was a sunny afternoon, late in the afternoon. Guy came up with a gun, attacked us, and stole my girlfriend's bag. And I ran after him. I just had a bad day, I think. And this was just the topper. I didn't really want to deal with anything, but I just felt... you just never know until it happens to you, I suppose, how a person reacts.
Well, that's the thing. Did you decide to chase after this guy with a gun, or did you just reflexively do it without even thinking?
Well, the irony is that near the end of this record took a long time to make,
mm-hmm.
and I was really losing my temper with myself and everybody around. I was irritable, not nice to be around because I hadn't finished my work, and that was left in England. But after that, we'd been to a restaurant, and I just decided to be a calmer, better, easygoing person. And actually, I don't mind if I don't finish this record or I don't mix this record. I'm going to relax here, maybe buy a place here and live in New Orleans and walk out and get shot. And in a sense, I was put into hospital, and my injuries were quite more severe or serious than people realized. But it gave me the incentive to get back and come to terms with finishing my record and getting it done. That was my quest after that.
So when your girlfriend's purse got nabbed by this guy or guy with a gun, did you just reflexively run after him or did you make a conscious decision?
It's a question I'll always ask myself, and I'm still trying to work that out.
You're not sure?
Not sure. I just didn't feel it was right to be treated that way. And this is so difficult to talk about, but he was really scared, and he's the one that had the gun. I got a close look at him, and he was really scared. And I just felt it was... it was not right to let him get away with it. And I didn't know there was a car waiting and a driver. And he stopped. I nearly caught him and he stopped at the car and just turned around and shot me.
You, like everybody who watches TV or goes to the movies has seen a lot of people shot over the years on screen. What surprised you most about what it's like to be shot in real life as opposed to what it looks like in the movies?
You know, I was kept in this hospital, this grand but sad, and now I think it's a derelict hospital called Charity Hospital. At the time, it was running at full, you know, its full powers for what that's worth. And they did the best there, but they had very limited resources.
Well, it's a hospital for the poor.
It's a poor town, as everybody knows now. And
how did you end up in a hospital for the poor?
Because I was just a body brought in in an ambulance. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't wave, say, "Hey, I'm Ray Davis, and I've been shot." It actually hurts. And they took me to the hospital, and I remember them having. I was in hospital. My leg was broken. They didn't know it. So they tried to get me to walk in the hospital, and it finally snapped while I was in the hospital.
Oh, that must have hurt.
They were just relieved that I was alive. Uh-huh. And anyway, I was in the ward, and they had a telethon on. They had one television on in the ward all the time, and it was a James Bond telethon.
Oh, no.
And people are getting shot all the time.
That's so funny.
And they just fall over, and that's it.
But they quip. They always quip when they're shot in James Bond movies.
You've had your shot. There's always a James Bond quip. Yeah. And I just watched it with the sound turned down. You know, I didn't really pay much attention. It hurts. And I feel, you know, you just feel how every day, you know, we see on television in horrible wars now, are televised live almost. Yeah, the suffering that goes on. It just made me appreciate that a little more. How terrible all these bombings are, and it's and explosions and war in general.
If you don't mind my asking, was there a moment where you saw the shooter looking at you and taking aim, and you knew was there a moment you knew you were going to get shot?
Yeah, it was a classic, you know, how they train people to shoot guns, you know, that position, that crouch position.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just ran, dived, like they do in the movies. And I try not to think about it, because there are only fragments, you know. It's like writing songs, it's a line, one-liners. It's not a constant memory, a constant replay.
So I mean, like, even when you think about it, you only have fragments of that memory. There isn't one complete connected narrative that you have.
Yeah, it's just like songwriting.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. Would you ever write a song about this?
I already had at that time. The song was called I, the Victim. And that's the most harrowing part of this whole process. It was the recovery process that was the most difficult, because I had to go back to my music. And there's a song on the album called After the Fall. There's a song on the album about tourists, take the money, you know, attack the tourists, whatever. And I'd written the song I, the Victim, which was almost the incident played out. And I don't know if I'll go back to that. It may come out on another record, but it's...
Would you recite or talk a few of the lines?
I didn't write a song called You Really Shot Me. I don't recommend it for any aspiring songwriters if they're looking for source material.
Your life seems like it's been very eventful lately, but you were shot. Your brother had a stroke. How severe was it? Like, does he have his memory and his ability to talk and sing and walk?
He has all those, thankfully, but it's getting back to normality for him is difficult. And he never does things slowly. He's like me, but we've lived quite pressured lives, you know, a lot of pressure traveling, doing things. And he's playing again.
He can play guitar.
He stayed with me for a few months when he was recovering. This happened over a year ago.
That's interesting that you stayed together for a few months, because, you know, everything I read about your relationship is that it's this really rocky relationship. You only see each other when you perform.
Yep.
And, you know, that's part of the reason why the Kinks aren't really together.
Mm.
And I guess after the stroke, you got close?
I've never been not close to him. It's just that we have all siblings are the same. I think they fall out, some more than others, and happens that we fall out a lot. But, you know, it was kind of, he wasn't helpless. He's recovered really well. I'd see him in hospital. And I was just trying to do the right thing. Now both our parents are dead. And I think it was the right thing to do, try and look after him. And look after him, you know. He had his girlfriend with him and they stayed in another part of the house. And but we'd eat dinner together and that was really good, watch movies. And as he started to recover, he got more aggressive towards me and now he's back to normality.
Still into those big power chord kind of thing?
He's still, you know, my brother's got incredible hands. He's got very strong hands. And I was auditioning all these guitar players, and with no disrespect to any of them, there were so many great players, but nobody could hit power chords like Dave. It's just like it's just something he put his body through. You know, it's just like it's like one of those karate people. You know, they've got those very strong hands.
Ray Davies, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, as always.
Ray Davies recorded in April. The solo album he released this year is called Other People's Lives. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, in stores and online at bn.com. And from Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our holiday week series of music interviews with Tom Petty. He'll talk about his music and the fire started by an arsonist that burned down his house and everything in it. He released a new solo CD this year.
It's all right if you love me. It's alright if you don't. I'm not afraid of you running away, honey. I get the feeling you owe. There is no sense in pretending. Your eyes give you away. Something inside you is feeling like I do. Is it all there is to say?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We continue our holiday week music series with singer, guitarist, and songwriter Tom Petty. This year marked the 30th anniversary of his first album with his band The Heartbreakers. Since then, they've sold more than 50 million records. Petty's songs include American Girl, Breakdown, Listen to Her Heart, Don't Do Me Like That, Refugee, I Won't Back Down, and Running Down a Dream. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2002, the first year they were eligible. As a member of the Traveling Wilburys from 1988 to 1990, Petty performed with several of the people he most admired, Bob Dylan, George Harrison, and Roy Orbison. I spoke with Petty in July when he released a solo CD of new songs called Highway Companion. Let's start with the opening track, Saving Grace.
I'm passing sleeping cities, fading by degrees, not believing all I see to be so. I'm flying over backyards, country homes and ranches, watching life between the branches below. And it's hard to say who you are these days, but you run on anyway, don't you, baby? You keep running for another place to find that saving grace. I'm moving on alone over ground that no one owns, past statues that atone for my sins.
In addition to recording and touring, Tom Petty hosts his own radio show on the XM Satellite Network. I asked him what radio meant to him as a kid.
Everything. You know, I still see it as this really magical thing. It was wonderful. I didn't have the money to have a vast record collection, so I learned everything, really, from the radio. And in the, you know, in the mid-60s, AM radio, pop radio, was just this incredible thing that played all kinds of music, you know, just you could hear Frank Sinatra right into the Yardbirds, you know, or the Beatles, into Dean Martin. It was just, it was this amazing thing, and I miss it in a way, because music has become so compartmentalized now, but in those days it was all right in one spot. And that's, you know, we used to learn, you know, when I was 15 or 16 playing in groups, we used to sit in the car and try to write the lyrics down as the song was playing. And we'd assign each person a verse. You know, I'm going to do the first one, and you go for the second one. And then sometimes you'd wait an hour for it to come on again, you know, so you could finish it up.
What's a song you did that with?
I'll tell you, the hardest one was Get Off My Cloud by the Stones. It had so many words.
Oh, and fast, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it took us a good three hours to get that one written down. But it was that kind of thing. It was a friend, you know, and it was something that was there. You didn't really think about it that much, but looking back on it, it was such a musical education.
You grew up in Gainesville, Florida. I know, I think there's a branch of the University of Florida in Gainesville, right?
It is there, the University of Florida, the whole thing.
So were you in a college part of Gainesville, or were you in a different part of town?
No, I was in the redneck hillbilly part. I wasn't part of the academic circle, but it's an interesting place because you can meet almost any kind of person from many walks of life because of the university. But it's really surrounded by this kind of very rural kind of people that are, you know, they're farmers or, you know, tractor drivers or, you know, just all kind of game wardens, you name it, you know. So it's an interesting blend. My family wasn't involved in the college, you know, they were more of just your white trash kind of, you know, family. And so I have that kind of background, but I always kind of aspired to be something else. And I made a lot of different friends over the years that were, you know, passing through.
Now, you had an uncle, I guess this is a famous story in your life, because you got to meet Elvis Presley on a movie set when you were 11, through an uncle of yours who was doing something on the set, though I'm not sure what.
Yeah, I had an uncle by marriage who was the kind of, he was very into film. He was the guy in town that developed all the film, and he had a movie camera. He used to film the the college basketball practices and football practices, and when a movie came nearby, as a lot of them did around northern Florida, he would usually hire on to a set and work in some capacity. And he was working on an Elvis Presley movie in 1961, I think, Follow That Dream, it was called. And I was invited there by my aunt, drove me down to see Elvis. And I really didn't have much idea of who Elvis was. I was only 11. But we did indeed go there, and it was quite a circus, you know, a lot of, as you'd expect, you know, mobs in the street, and he was just back from the army, and but I didn't really talk with him. I mean, he just sort of nodded my way, you know. Was introduced by my uncle as, you know, these are my nephew and my two cousins were with me, and he just, I don't remember what he said really, but I was very impressed by it. And when I went home, I kind of scoured the neighborhood and came up with some old Elvis records, and I started listening to them, and they really took me over, you know. And these were all 50s records, and I had a friend whose older sister had gone to college and left this beautiful box of 45s of rock and roll, you know, from the 50s, and I loved it, you know. It just spoke to me. It seemed like such a magical place, you know. And the odd thing was, in those days, there was no information about the records, you know. I was dying to know stuff about them, and there was no such thing then as a book on rock and roll or
liner notes.
Yeah, there were fan magazines, but there was nothing really, you know, intelligent, you know. There was, mm-hmm. you know, you could read Elvis's Favorite Color, but you really didn't know, you know, much about the records. And finally, I did find a book in England. I had to send away to England and pay send a buck to England, and they sent me a discography that lined up how the records, you know, came out and when they were made and this and that. And so from there on, I got really interested in all the you know, Jerry Lewis, Carl Perkins, all these people. So I was just this 11-year-old kid, and I was already, you know, not involved with my own generation until the Beatles came. I sort of felt, in the Stones and all that British invasion, I kind of felt like that was my generation. And that was interesting to me because they were playing this 50s music in a slightly different way.
So how long did it take after that until you started to play something yourself?
Well, the idea had never dawned on me until I saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, like so many musicians did. I didn't think you could just become a rock and roll singer. I didn't see how it could happen, you know, because you needed to be in a movie and have the music appear on the beach and stuff. So I didn't see how one would get that together, you know. So when I saw the Beatles, it sort of hit me like a lightning bolt to the brain that, oh, I see, you know, you have your friends and you all learn an instrument and you're a self-contained unit. This is brilliant, you know, and this looks like a great, great job to me. And apparently it did to lots of people, because very quickly after that, there were bands forming, you know, in garages all over town. And I was just one in, you know, thousands of little bands that started then in around 64, 65.
My guest is Tom Petty. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Petty. His new solo CD is called Highway Companion. Here's a hit from his first album with the Heartbreakers, released 30 years ago. Roger McGuinn and the Byrds influenced you and influenced your guitar sound. He later recorded this song. What did it mean to you to, years later, after having been influenced by him, to have him record your song?
No, I was stunned. I couldn't believe it. And, you know, I couldn't believe, you know, people said, you sound like the Byrds. Well, we couldn't believe that we would, you know, even had the talent to sound like the Byrds, you know. So I was very taken back by it, and I was quickly invited over to meet Roger McGuinn. And I was very intimidated, but I went over and met him, and he told me that, he said, when I first heard this record, I thought it was, for a few minutes, I thought it was a Byrds outtake. And he invited us on tour with him, and we did go out on tour and became friends. We're still friends to this day, really.
Let me play another song that was, it's a great song, and it was a very popular song of yours. Johnny Cash recorded the song late in his life, and the song is I Won't Back Down, which you recorded in 1989. I know it's hard to talk about writing songs, but is there a story behind this one?
I wrote this song with Jeff Lynne. We wrote it in the studio while we were mixing another song, and it came very quickly, and I was actually worried about it. I thought that it was maybe just too direct. You know, I thought, well, there isn't really anything to hide behind here. You know, it's very bold and very blunt. There's not a lot of metaphor or any, you know, anywhere to go. And but I was encouraged by Jeff that, you know, no, it's really good. You should record this and go ahead with it. And it's turned out to be maybe, you know, the one song that's had the most influence on people that approach me on the street or talk to me in a restaurant or wherever I go, or mail that I've gotten over the years. It's been really important to a lot of people in their lives. And I'm glad I wrote it, and I'm kind of proud of it these days. And I was very, very proud when Johnny Cash did it.
Well, let's hear it from 1989. This is Tom Petty.
Turn
That's Tom Petty, recorded in 1989. He has a new CD that's called Highway Companion. You recorded that song just a couple of years after an arsonist burned down your house. And the house was set on fire while you and your family were in it. Did your instincts kick in like they were supposed to when you realized that your house was on fire and that you and your wife and child had to get out of there?
They kick in pretty fast, you know, when your house is on fire. Yeah, they kicked in really fast, and it was a pretty horrific thing to happen, and I did just survive with the, you know, the clothes on my back, but I don't know. Maybe that had something to do with the songs like I Won't Back Down and things, because I felt really elated that they didn't get me, you know? Like, I kind of just, that was the thought that was going through my head as well. You bastard, you didn't get me, you know? I survived. But it's very hard to even believe that someone wants to kill you, you know? It's a very hard thing to go through. And, you know, when the police and the arson people are telling me that, you know, someone did it, I'm just going, well, surely there's a mistake, you know? It must have been a bad wire, or, you know? And, you know, they were absolutely sure there was no mistake, so... The interesting thing about that is how many people called and confessed the following day.
Oh, you're kidding. Really?
You know, yeah, they were confessing from all over America. And it was like, you know, people in New Jersey would call and confess. Then I realized just how bonkers people are, you know. It's like they're there are some people that are really bonkers, and you have to be careful. But, you know, that was a... You know, that I never really talked about that much because it stunned me so deeply. And I'm sure it had a great effect on the music I did, because I came back with this very positive, happy kind of music that I didn't want to go into any dark corner or anything like that. I was just so glad to be alive and to have escaped something like that. And you know, it was also really traumatic and terrible, but part of it made me really be extra glad to just be alive.
My guest is Tom Petty. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview I recorded last July with songwriter, singer, and guitarist Tom Petty. The album he released this year is called Highway Companion. I want to play another record here, and this is one of Johnny Cash's albums. On the album Unchained, which was one of the albums he made later in his life, in that great series of American recordings. Yeah, you and the Heartbreakers backed him up on this. And how of all the bands in the world, how did you get to play with him?
Well, we have been friends a long time. I think 20 years when we did Unchained. I mean,
you and Johnny Cash have been friends?
Yeah. We became friends back in the early 80s. And John had made this... He was, you know, he was breaking out of a thing too, where he had kind of been disappointed in what he was doing in the Nashville world, you know, and he made this acoustic album that was really brilliant. It was his first American record. And then I guess the plan for the next one was to make a band record with a band. And he came to me, him and Rick Rubin, actually at the time we were talking about, when I was going through a pretty tough period. And they called me one day, both of them on the phone, and said, hey, why don't you come and play the bass on this record we're going to do? And I thought, that's great, you know. And so they got me out of the house, and then it grew from me playing the bass on the record to, hey, how about the Heartbreakers playing on the record? And it was a wonderful time, you know. We all went down and made a whole album with Johnny Cash, and it's I think it's some of the best playing the Heartbreakers ever did, you know. It turned out just great. I love that album to this day.
Well, here's a track from it. This is Sea of Heartbreak, Johnny Cash with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
One, two, three, four. The lights in the harbor don't shine for me. I'm like a lost ship adrift on the sea. This sea of heartbreak, lost love and loneliness, memories of your caress, so divine. How I wish you were mine again, my dear. I'm on this sea of tears, sea of heartbreak. Oh, how did I lose. Did I fail? Why did you leave me always to sail? This sea of heartbreak, lost love and loneliness, memories of your caress, so divine. How I wish you were mine again, my dear. I'm on this sea of tears, sea of heartbreak. Oh, what I'd give just to sail back to shore, back to your arms once more. Come to my rescue, oh, come here to me. Take me and keep me away from the sea. Sea of heartbreak, lost love and loneliness, memories of your caress, so divine. How I wish you were mine again, my dear. I'm on this sea of tears, sea of heartbreak.
I think that when you're young and you fall in love with a song, it has this incredible impact on you, and the song just kind of stays in your mind for the rest of your life, and every time you hear it, you think about what that song meant to you and how your feelings about the song has evolved over the years. And you have like a bunch of songs that have that kind of place in people's minds. And I wonder if you think about that a lot, if you think about that special place that great songs have in the lives of young people and teenagers when they first hear them over and over.
I know the songs mean a lot to people, and it means a lot to me. You know, we just played this Bonnaroo Festival up in, it's in Tennessee. And, you know, there were 80,000 people there, and they were singing, you know, and I Won't Back Down so loud that it nearly drowned us out, you know. And I was thinking at the time, you know, God, this is just so wonderful that this has reached people on this level, you know, and that people know the words to these things and it means something to them. So I don't want to sell them out if I don't have to. You know? And I know that a lot of music has meant, you know, has been important to me. You know, the rock and roll stuff is more than just something that you can manipulate into advertising or whatever they do with them. It means more than that to me. Right or wrong, that's what it, you know, that's the way I am.
Well, Tom Petty, thank you so much, and congratulations on the new CD and on, you know, 30 years with the Heartbreakers. That's it's kind of incredible. Thanks
okay,
so much
well,
for talking
thank you
with
for
us.
Thanks for having me. It was nice to be here.
Tom Petty recorded over the summer when his solo album Highway Companion was released. Our Holiday Week series of recent interviews with great songwriters and singers continues tomorrow. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Therapy is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I was talking with a friend of mine. Said a woman that hurt his pride. Told him that she loved him so. And turn around and let him go. Then he said you better watch yourself.
Support for NPR comes from BMW, where drivers can customize their new BMWs and their delivery destination. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. From the Cato Charitable Foundation, advancing environmental values and saluting all those who work to sustain our world. And from Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting The Good German, a new film by Steven Soderbergh starring George Clooney, Cate Blanchett, and Tobey Maguire, now playing. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our Holiday Week series of music interviews with Tom York of Radiohead and Stuart Murdoch of Belle and Sebastian. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.